It's tough to pick out the most charming term of endearment that Paul West made up to describe his wife, Diane Ackerman, while he was recovering from serious stroke. Here are a few. My little bucket of hair, spy elf of the morning alleluias, apostle of radiant postage stamps, little moon skipper of the tumbleweed factory. West, who's a writer, suffered a stroke in 2003 that left him completely at a loss for words. He was diagnosed with severe global aphasia. Ackerman created a therapy for her husband that played to his strengths, his extraordinary vocabulary, his passion for language, and their playful verbal relationship. At her urging, he created pet names for her. Diane Ackerman writes about all of this in her new book called 100 Names for Love, A Stroke, A Marriage, and the Language of Healing. And she joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. And Diane Ackerman, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. I'm delighted to see you again.
And I'm enjoying your, not little bucket of hair, but your large bucket of hair.
Yes, it's more of a weather system than a hairdo. So you can see why when he strolled out of the bedroom and put his hand over his heart as if he were going to do the Pledge of Allegiance and said, "My little bucket of hair."
There
I
you
was
were.
Just tickled. Yeah.
He got he was actually sick in the hospital, and you came back from a book tour to be with him. He had an infection.
He did. He had a bladder infection, and I happened just coincidentally to be on tour with a book about the brain. So I knew in chilling detail what had happened to him. I was the best person, I suppose, but certainly the worst person, too, to have a spouse who'd had a stroke.
He was in the hospital for a couple of weeks with this infection.
Yes.
And then literally... He has a stroke.
He had a stroke. And he had had a transient stroke some years before, and I knew all the symptoms. I knew exactly what had happened. What I didn't know is if he would also recover quickly mm-hmm. from this, or if this affliction would be with him.
And what did that stroke look like to you when you saw it?
His eyes were glazed. His mouth had fallen like mud. And he looked at me with eyes that were not expressive, but they were full of alarm. So he wasn't squinting them or anything, but I could just read the alarm in his eyes. And I said to him, "Are you having a stroke?" And he just looked at me.
He couldn't say anything.
He couldn't say a word. He had the worst possible kind of stroke. Sometimes people get one kind where they can't speak well, but they understand what people are saying. And in the cruelest of ironies for the author of nearly 50 books, and for his word-obsessed wife, he had a stroke that mainly hit the language areas of his brain. And he could no longer understand anything anyone said to him. But he also couldn't read, write, read clocks, do math.
Or speak.
Or speak, most importantly, or speak or swallow food.
Well, I would love to have you read a section from the beginning of your book, and this is where you see that he has a stroke. He's in the hospital, and there you two are.
"Don't leave me," I silently pleaded. Instead, time and space did, rotating around both of us, and I felt tippy as if I were on shipboard in a bow-cracking storm. The bed's stainless steel began frying sparks. The walls curved into a bowl, and the nurse's voice scratched like an old-fashioned Victrola needle. As for Paul, he later told me that he'd felt assaulted by things bright and metallic, a twitch in every fiber of his being, bouncing pulses, weird ringing in his ears. There were odder phenomena, too, from a shaking sound in his head to a noise like crumbled tea leaves from somewhere in his lumbar region. Also, a belfry of quiet tinkling that roamed around his head. As his world tried to right itself between earth and heaven, he felt the presence of a wispy halo, making him wonder if he'd become one of the elect. Whenever the belfry sounds decreased for a slim moment, it drove him mad with delight. The dark night of the merry-go-round flashed through his mind. In his mouth a taste balsamic and crude, which he fixed upon with all the rapture of a man touching a toothache in the night. His fingers, partially deprived of sensation, felt wax-like, dull, opaque, brutalized, and wouldn't respond. His whole body defied touch, as his flesh converted to something stiffer. It wasn't an unpleasant sensation, just different. He felt somewhere, without thinking the words, "What's happening? I'm still alive, sort of. A British policeman's stern baritone demanded, "What's all this here?"
And again, Diane Ackerman reading from her new book called 100 Names for Love. And your husband is able to recover some of this language. He also begins to write. So we not only see and learn about your experiences of his stroke, but his experience of having a stroke, which seems to me an extraordinary thing to learn.
Very, very rare. Because by definition, somebody who has global aphasia can't tell you. And so I was able to find out a lot of what goes on in the mind of somebody who's having a stroke. And I discovered, for example, that they continue to have that dialogue that we have with ourselves. He heard speaking. It's just that because his brain was all miswired, he couldn't give the signal to his mouth to express it. And in time, when he began to get back just a couple of words, words would tumble out that he didn't want to. And that's often what happens, that somebody who's had a stroke can only say what the mouth can utter, not what they mean. And it can sound very confusing, but, you know, it can also sound very funny, and you can really enjoy it.
Well, you just, in that description is all the sort of noise, the clanking in his head.
Yes, he said that he actually felt his teeth blink.
Now, what do you think he meant by
that? I have no idea. I think his mouth felt very strange, the sensations, the nerves, yes.
He also writes, and this is when he begins to write, "On rare occasions, the word I sought lay like an angel begging to be used." And the idea that, you know, the word is over there, right?
Yes.
You just can't get to it.
Yes, it was horribly frustrating for him. And my challenge, among other things, among trying to keep together what had been a very long, sentimental, romantic, kissy love affair, was also to help him get back as much language as possible. And I discovered very quickly that all of the normal speech therapy that was taking place with him, because we went through five different therapists, really was just not right for someone like Paul, who was way too imaginative. But I think it was perhaps too rigid, too textbook, to work best maybe for anyone. It really was designed only for people with acute problems. And as I know from being a teacher, there are two ways to teach anything. You can teach from the lesson book, or you can figure out how the student needs to learn. And that takes a lot more work, but to individualize it like that is so much more effective.
And I'm wondering whether more traditional therapy would, and I'm holding up a pen in front of you, so someone would say to your husband, "This is a pen," and try to get him to say the word pen?
Yes, exactly. But I was walking through our little home library one day when a therapist was showing him a photograph of a telephone on a table. And she pointed to the table and she said, "What's this?" And he said, "Skylargle." And she said, "No, that's nonsense. It's a table." "What's this?" And she pointed to the telephone and he said, "Tesseract." And she said, "No, that's nonsense." But at that moment, really the trajectory of our lives changed because something dawned on me. And I turned around and went back in and said, "You know, actually, a tesseract is a real word. It's a three-dimensional object unfolded into the fourth dimension. And in a funny way, that's what a telephone does." And I began to realize that, okay, the words that we learn as children are processed in the language areas of the brain.
Here's a pen, right?
Exactly. You know, that's mother. There's the sky. But it was possible that words that we learn as adults, maybe in hobbies or specialties, get processed elsewhere like a foreign language. And at that point, I just took over his therapy and started to work with him through that new vocabulary.
And you write about the fact, and you're both writers, so one can imagine, you know, the sort of land of language that you inhabited together. I mean, I think couples that love each other and spend time together create a language
they
for
do.
Each other.
I think love is essentially a cult of two with fallible gods and has its
a
own
folie à deux, don't you think?
Yes, and has its own special rituals and lingo and everything. So there are other ways, and always the hobbies, the interests. There are different ways to do this.
And he had, before his stroke, had all sorts of pet names for you, I guess.
Yes.
Endearing, loving names for
you. Well, he used to make up little operettas about me in the course of the day. He would just improvise because we always were very playful. And if you're word people, of course, you play with words. And yes, and he lamented that he couldn't remember even one. He seemed so sad. And I was sad that he seemed to have lost his ability to describe things in images. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, why don't you make up some new ones? And so casting about, he let the aphasia tumble out a little bit, just enough, and he had the thrill of being able to control it a little bit and whip out one a day for 100 days in a row.
Well, and, I, you know, it's hard for me to pick my favorite here, but I love Apostle of Radiant postage stamps. I mean, that's just,
well, I like that,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, what else do you like? And I should say to our listeners that these names are in the very back of Diane Eckerman's new book. Are there some ones that you just resonate with in particular?
Yes, I like Fleet-Footed Empress of Sleep, Rheostat of Sentimental Dreaming, My Little Celestial Porcupine. Now, this one is strange. My Billiard Table of the Decaying Gods. Where did that come from?
I circled that one because that seems so strangely delightful.
But how about Dark-Eyed Junko, My Little Bunko?
Yeah.
Or O Singing Squirrel of the Antipodes? and then maybe my favorite, because it just sounds like Whitman, I think.
Yeah.
O Parakeet of the Lissom Star.
Wow. And right before that, Little Flavonoid Wonder.
Oh, I love that one, too. and Bobby Dazzler of the Golden Morn. He means the British bobbies, the policemen.
But you think, and this was every day, so he was, you gave him permission to just let the words come out.
Exactly.
Don't worry what they mean. Don't worry if they make sense together.
Yes, just, and this was really one of the strategies that I used, too, was circumlocution. Say, in order to communicate, use anything that you can. And even if you need to do it in a roundabout way, let your brain hunt and do it, because what comes out can be very funny, and it's nice if you make people laugh. For example, we had ants in the kitchen, and he couldn't find the word ants, so he called them a cache of creepy crawlies. But I knew what he meant. Or maybe my favorite, one morning, he came out of the bedroom, he found me in my study, and he said, "Where's my cantilever of light?" I said, "Do you mean your velour jogging suit?" He said, "Yes." I said, "It's in the laundry room." And then we just cracked up laughing because we'd been together so long that I knew
what he was talking about.
That cantilever of light meant velour jogging suit, yes.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Diane Eckerman is our guest. She's got a brand new book called 100 Names for Love, and it's subtitled A Stroke, A Marriage, and the Language of Healing. Much more to talk about after this short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Lancaster City Arts is proud to support WHYY. Lancaster City Arts, 125 art venues, all within one walkable community. From galleries, art studios, museums, and an art college, to music, poetry, dance, photography, professional theater, and symphony. It's an opportunity to explore something different in an art scene that's quite unexpected itself. Lancaster City Arts. The journey starts online at lancasterarts.com.
Hello, my name is Elder Price, and I would like to share with you the most amazing book.
On the next Fresh Air, Trey Parker and Matt Stone, the creators of South Park, tell us about their new hit Broadway musical, The Book of Mormon. It's nominated for 14 Tonys. Join us.
Hello. This afternoon at 3, and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
My name is Elder Smith.
Teens interested in journalism can use WHYY's production equipment to create news stories based on their interests during the Young Journalist Summer Camp. And for budding young filmmakers, the WHYY Film Academy teaches students to produce their own short films from script to screen. Learn from professionals. Express your ideas. Both camps are for students currently in 9th to 12th grade. Learn more at whyy.org/Hamilton Commons or 215-351-0511.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Diane Ackerman. She's got a new book called 100 Names for Love, and it's about a stroke that her husband Paul West suffered back in, 2003, and how using kind of playful, flirty language, they were able to help him not only speak again, but also to write again as well. And it has... surprise, surprise, changed their marriage. They're still together. And she joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. Let me just go back to when your husband was beginning to utter sounds. And one of the words you come in, and one of the words he says to you is mim.
Mim was all he could say. And this happens so often. For example, in the case of the poet Baudelaire, when he had a stroke, all he could say was goddamn. And that was especially awkward because he was being taken care of by nuns.
Oh, wow.
Very bad. They thought he was blaspheming all day. But people...
Maybe he was.
Maybe he was. Good point, knowing Baudelaire. Some people can only say yes or can only say chicken or whatever. He was left with this one syllable. But early on, I decided that I should just try to drench him in language. And to that end, among other things, I hired the most wonderful, cute, young nursing student named Liz, who came over, and her job was partly to swim with him for a couple of hours. She was a self-described chatterbox, so she was to talk with him nonstop and, oh yes, show up with her bikini.
I was going to say, and the bikini helps too, right?
I thought it would help him pay attention.
You're a good wife.
I know. And from morning to night, he was surrounded by language. I think that in his case, that was very important. But I also made up frisky little Mad Libs for him to do. And we just had to find new ways to play. It isn't just a question of people who have a stroke. When any kind of crisis happens in a marriage, the first thing that goes is laughter and play. And I feel very strongly, having been married now for 41 years, that if you're married any length of time, it's not one marriage, it's several marriages, because things happen to you and you change. Mm. And if you are going to thrive as a couple and continue on and not get divorced, you have to be able to embrace those changes and you have to find ways to continue having fun.
And mim, I guess, meant many things. I guess he could say it in many different ways, but that was, I guess, the beginning of this.
That he could utter sound
at all.
Could
say sound at all.
Yes, was dramatically important. And then it became a question of what else could he say. Mm-hmm. By the time he left the hospital, he was sitting on the edge of the bed looking at me radiantly and saying, "Surprise." I said, "Yes." He said, "I talk good coffee." I said, "You talk good coffee." Yes.
And meaning so, good English.
Exactly.
I guess, right.
And so at that point, he had a few words and home he came.
Well, you also describe, and I think anyone in your situation becomes this caregiver. And you make a very interesting distinction between a caregiver role, saying it's not a relationship. I mean, it is a relationship, but you have a role and responsibility to this person.
Because stroke hits 5 to 6 million people, and then there's everybody else out there who's faced with illness in the family or dealing with ill parents or grandparents and so on. Everybody is going to become a caregiver at some point in their life if they live long enough. That's what happens. And the question is how to do it with grace and with patience and with love and with generosity. And it's not an easy thing to do. And very often caregivers beat up on themselves because they feel they're not doing enough. But the truth is that caregiving is very hard work.
Sure.
It's a full-time job. It really can't be done alone. You need to ask for help, and there are agencies around that will help you or family members. And it reduces one to a role rather than to a relationship. Normally, when you have a relationship, you play a great many roles.
Sure.
You could be sometimes a lover, a mother, you know, the prom queen, the monkey baby, whatever.
The bucket of hair.
The bucket of hair, whatever it's going to be. The judge and jury, who knows? But in the case of caregiving, you're locked into a role. And that's very hard to get used to. And you need to find ways to make it possible, not just for you, but for your loved one also.
A friend says to you, how are you feeling? I guess this is kind of early on, and
yes,
you say, I'm a mess.
I'm a mess. I don't really know how I'm feeling, except that I'm a mess. And that's normal. I think none of my readers knew that I was writing The Zookeeper's Wife after this happened. It really was my sanctuary to be working.
To where you could go to your work, your words, your world,
yes,
your imagination.
All of that.
But again, interestingly, Paul, your husband, has been able to write about his experience, and one that I underscored here. And you're taking care of him. You're doing that. And he writes, here she is cuddling her overgrown baby, who at once had been the terror on the cricket field, her blue baby, her deformed baby, her armless protege, at once older, younger, doomed, a magnet for any human task, and therefore enormously to be pitied, before being put down, buried, gravestone naked, and maybe plundered by grave robbers and carted away.
Well,
as a
good
freak.
Lord, I had no idea he was feeling that
but
at the time.
But you were taking care of him, and
yes,
that was his experience.
That was his experience, which he could not express.
Right.
Of course, when you live with someone, even if there's no illness in the family, you don't really know what's going on in their mind. Mm-hmm. And if they wrote a book about the relationship and you wrote a book, they'd be very different books.
But knowing that now, does it make you rethink your caretaking? Or is it, this is just what happens when someone has a stroke and someone else has to take care of them?
It really does. I wish I had known then what I know now. I've learned so many lessons, not just lessons about being a caregiver, lessons really about, as I say, keeping love alive too in the face of heartache, that I just didn't know then. There were no books to turn to.
And that's Diane Ackerman, our guest today on Radio Times. I do want to open up our lines at our phone lines, I should say, at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. She's written a number of books. The new one is called 100 Names for Love, and it's subtitled A Stroke, A Marriage, and the Language of Healing. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. You describe Oliver Sacks coming over. He's been a guest on the show and has written these extraordinary books about neurological conditions, even his own condition. Musicophilia was one that that we talked to him about. And he's with your husband, and they're singing.
Yes, that was wonderful. I had been to a dinner party with him the night before. When he heard that Paul had a stroke, he thought this was so tragic. He asked if he could come pay a visit. And he wanted to show Paul that it's possible to sing things that you might not be able to say because of stuttering or stroke or whatever. And let me tell you, it's very funny to see these two guys remembering their school days in England, singing Blake's Jerusalem, you know, and Happy Birthday on the couch. It was charming.
But he was able to sing, right? It was
he was able to sing.
Another part of the brain?
That's exactly what happens. And Oliver also shared with us some insight that I never forgot, and that was that regardless of what doctors and books tell you, that there is only a short window of opportunity, and whatever you don't get back in the first few months after traumatic brain injury, you're never going to have. That's just not true.
Yeah.
We know now that the brain is very, very plastic. And in a nutshell, that means don't lose hope.
Oliver Sacks is a swimmer, I know. And your husband also was
a swimmer.
Also a swimmer as well. Do you think there was something about the buoyancy, the feeling of water on the body that was...
I think so. I once wrote an entire play in the bathtub.
Did you?
Yes. Not all in one sitting. But there's something quite wonderful about having the rest of your senses kind of on neutral, and your brain can just function. But there's also something mystical about being outside and hearing the birds, mm-hmm, and the sun sparkling on the water and all of that.
And he, this meaning your husband, was swimming with this assistant that you hired.
Yes, or with me.
Or with you. And just, what, talking and swimming and talking and swimming.
Exactly, talking and swimming and listening, mm-hmm, and hearing the rhythms of language again and really wanting to communicate and trying and being praised for every effort and being encouraged.
And do you think also being relaxed? Because I would think there's so much focus on getting the language back that that could create a lot of tension.
Well, if people have seen the King's Speech, they know that the minute you have any kind of stress involved, then stuttering is so much harder. And so is speaking for somebody with aphasia or somebody who has performance anxiety. So if you can get rid of the stress, well, that makes it much easier.
And the fact that this assistant wore a little bikini?
It didn't hurt. Didn't hurt, nor did it hurt that because I couldn't communicate through language well with him, I initiated early on early morning wake-up sessions of cuddling for about an hour. We would just be in bed cuddling and cuddling, and it was just so much easier for him, you know, kind of waking up dreamy to find words.
And obviously relaxed.
Very relaxed that way. Mm-hmm. And we would laugh and we would joke. And it made life just so much better in every sense.
And how much language does your husband I should say he's written, what, a couple of books?
He has written he's still aphasic. Right. And he will always be aphasic. This is not something one recovers from. Mm-hmm. It's something you improve. So in that sense, it can be like diabetes. And I should point out that Gabrielle Giffords was injured in the same part of the brain. And so my heart just fiercely went out to her because I knew some of what she would be going through mm-hmm. with language, and also that it might take a while to get back some use of this. Paul, now 6 years later, has about 3 really fluent hours each day when he has to choose what he wants to do. Mm. He can have lunch with someone, he can talk on the phone, or he can write. He can't do all 3. Maybe that's sort of like it is for all of us. We have to decide what we're going to use our day's energy for. He is 82. Mm. And so all of the age-related things come in also.
And do those 3 hours change? Or is morning better than evening?
Is better. Yes, he sundowns. And sometimes people are acquainted with this in terms of Alzheimer's mm-hmm. patients. As the day goes on, the brain gets tired from being used so much, and it's easier for them to be confused. They don't have access to as many words and so on. So what we do after dinner is watch a movie. Almost every night, we've been watching the Hercule Poirot mysteries and laughing at that wonderful little Belgian detective and his pranks, and we do things like that.
Right. Does he know then what... When he is when he's aphasic, or feeling that part of the day where he's more aphasic than I guess other parts of the day, does he know what's going on?
He does. He does, and he laughs also about the funny things that he will say because he can't say something else. For the longest time, he couldn't ask for the dessert that he liked, which was called Slim Bear. All he could remember is that it was something small and an animal, and he kept asking for a tiny elephant. you know, and then we would laugh and laugh, and we would get it. But Liz and Paul and I then would get together for what we called wombat tea time, because I started, for some reason I won't go into, calling him my little wombat. And that was the time of day when we would gather on the couch, and we would report to each other what was going on. And in our household, always something bizarre, because if you have 2 authors, somebody is in Poland, the other person is in Mozambique, somebody is writing about World War II, whatever. Liz had all of her own family dramas that she was bringing in, and we would just sit and laugh together, which was great.
Well, and I think wombats, I mean, it's such a wonderful animal to, you know, to call one's loved one.
A cute little, cuddly wombat.
And I should say that your book is dedicated for P. Wombat. I'm assuming that's Paul.
Uh-huh.
And for L. Wombat, which would be Liz.
Who really has become part of the family. We were very, very fortunate. She's just wickedly smart and very verbal.
And so apparently very organized.
Oh, yes. Fabulously organized. All of that has been a godsend.
You and your husband have often used animals as a form of endearment. Is that
yes,
been a theme for you?
We have. And so when the pet names went, you know, it was suddenly as if the zoo was empty. you know, or I had said that I was a one-woman zoo, and because he had so many pet names for me. He has a book called Life with Swan, and I'm Swan. And if you look at one of my other books, you will find secretly that my publisher embossed a little swan on the binding and so on. There are just lots of animal names. But I think people do this. We all have totemic names for one another. And really, there's a good discussion you could have about that and our animal origins, no matter how much we try to deny them. Obviously, we still feel very close to them.
Well, you also write, and this is about your relationship, when asked about the secret of our decade-long duet, I sometimes tease that we stayed together for the sake of the children. Each was each other's child.
Yes.
I like that.
Very true. And isn't that also true in families? You know, you find roles that make sense to one another. And if something happens to the other person, or if you get a divorce, not only do you lose that person, you lose the part of yourself that had a relationship with that part of the other person.
So did you raise each other then?
Suddenly after the stroke, he was my child, but I was no longer his child. And that was a rude awakening. And I came to him and told him this one day, and he put his hand on my chest, and he just said, safe. And he meant the little ones inside were safe.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, all the little children inside, right?
Exactly. As I was writing this book years later, Paul would come to me each day and he would ask me to read to him what I wrote that day. And how often does it happen that people really are candid with one another about what they've been going through? Not so often. But in this case, he heard me tell him by reading to him not only what happened to him, but what I was experiencing too. And it brought us so much closer together.
Does he remember, I mean, now that, he has some language and he's writing and he's talking, does he remember then what happened? I mean, he's written about it, but does he remember it?
The funny thing about memory for everybody is that it's only true to the moment of recall. Memories are never accurate to what actually took place. There have been all kinds of fascinating tests of people who have witnessed great events. And every time you remember something, you revise it according to who you are at that moment. And so at the time of the stroke, his brain was not making memories. Mine was too traumatized, really, to want to remember. And it was only later, when I told him what was going on, that suddenly he acquired memories. And he could then piece things together and help me find memories, and we helped each other remember.
Well, let's take another short break, and we'll get back to our conversation. Diane Ackerman is our guest today on Radio Times, and we're talking about her marriage to writer Paul West and a stroke that he suffered back in 2003, and how they used language and play and playful language to help him get some of his language back, also to help him write again, and he has written several books since that time. Her book is called 100 Names for Love, A Stroke, A Marriage, and the Language of Healing. Any questions or comments, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Eastern State Penitentiary Historic Site supports WHYY. The 2011 season features 10 innovative artist installations, including Release by filmmaker Bill Morrison, jazz composer Vijay Iyer, and curated by Julie Courtney, depicting Al Capone's release from ESP. Visitors can also experience the new hands-on history interactive activities and the voices of Eastern State Audio Tour narrated by actor Steve Buscemi. Open 7 days a week and Friday nights all summer. www.easternstate.org.
At WHYY-FM, we strive to bring you news and information that you can use throughout your day. Sometimes, there's just too much to tell in those short breaks on radio. News Works Tonight, more than a quick update on the latest headlines. A recap of the day's best news, plus all those other great stories we just couldn't fit in during the day. You know the kinds of stories, the ones that cause the driveway moments. It's the trusted local journalism you've come to expect from WHYY. Newsworks Tonight, weeknights at 6 on WHYY-FM.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Roger Clemens is set to go on trial for lying to Congress. Matt Taibbi of Rolling Stone says Goldman Sachs should go on trial as well. Also, President Obama's speech on the Middle East. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking with Diane Ackerman. She was on a book tour for a book called An Alchemy of the Mind when her husband, Paul West, was hospitalized for an infection. And she was at his bedside when he suffered a massive stroke that left him speechless, wordless. This was particularly painful because West is a writer, too, and words have been so important to their relationship. And this is what she writes about in her new book called 100 Names for Love, A Stroke, A Marriage, and the Language of Healing. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me also ask you something that he says, that these kind of voices that he had in his head. There was a BBC announcer. Who else was, in a sense, talking in his head?
Yes, he said that quite early on after the stroke, suddenly the one voice in your head that you hear broke into three voices, and they would tell him what to do. One was the BBC announcer from his childhood. Another was the slangy American. And the third was this barbaric-sounding person who could only make, like, guttural noises.
Wow.
Who had had a stroke.
Wow. And where are those voices today? Do you know?
Asked him not too long ago and said, what happened to the three voices? He said, they're still there. Uh-huh. I thought, oh, my God. They are, huh? But yes. And sometimes, oddly enough, when he was having trouble finding a word, this BBC announcer would hand it to him.
isn't the brain just a wonderful thing?
What a toy.
Yeah. So they're there and talking, chattering?
In the same way that you have this ongoing conversation, yes, really from birth to death, with yourself.
You met your husband. You were a student at Penn State University.
I was. It was in the
1970s.
Yes, it was in the 1970s, and I was a flower child, and he was a British professor with a very classy accent and wavy brown hair. And on our first, we kept bumping into each other on campus, and our first real date, we went to his house for drinks, and I just stayed for 40 years.
But you talked and talked and talked.
We talked all night. Yes, and we just never stopped talking. And to understand, I suppose, the real drama of the narrative, you need to know how it began and what was lost. And so I do go into that early on in the book. And it helps to know, I think, that he was, without exception, the most eccentric human I had ever met in my life.
In what way?
Well, he was afraid to be in the presence of fresh fruit or cucumbers or tomatoes. On at least one occasion, he flew to England sitting on a ream of typing paper to soften it up, he said. He didn't like having space over him, so I had to keep the moonroof in the car closed. He didn't like any weather at all if it wasn't mild and sunny. He didn't like wearing clothes, so he would walk around naked. And if he did have to make a concession and wear clothes, he only ever had two outfits. In the winter, he wore a velour jogging suit, and in the summer, he wore shorts and a blue short-sleeve shirt, and that was to either formal or informal occasions. But it wasn't an affectation. He came by it naturally. He came from a really eccentric family in which it was typical for him to go visit his aunts and uncles to find them all asleep in the living room, naked, with open books covering their privates. So it was just the family he came from.
But you also say that this stroke has made your husband a nicer person.
It did. He became much sweeter tempered after the stroke and deeply, deeply appreciative of life and of me. He suddenly began living in the moment in a way that he just never did before. Striving did not mean as much to him. He had lost what he called his Irish temper. He became happier than I had ever known him to be. I think because he woke up. You know, it was a moment of awakening. And he said, to be alive on this crazy blue planet and to be loved and love in return, how wonderful is that?
And does he still just wear two sets of clothing, or has he expanded his...
Yes, he does. And I feel, you know, the best marriage advice I ever got was choose your fight.
Huh.
And I never felt that that was worth fighting over. So wear anything you want, dear.
But you also talk about the fact, I don't know if he was an alcoholic, but that he...
He was.
He was. Does he still drink?
No.
No.
No, no. He was, before the stroke, some years before, when it was discovered that he had an irregular heartbeat and he had to have a pacemaker put in, the doctor, whose name, by the way, is Obeid, O-B-E-I-D, and we refer to him as He Who Must Be Obeid, yes, told him that he should go home and have his last cognac and his last cigar, and that's what he did.
Wow.
So, no, that was the end of it. But the alcohol damaged his heart.
Did you, I almost hate to ask this, but it's during this whole period, and obviously very tough time, and you've written a beautiful book about it, and obviously you can look back on it, but was there a time during this whole recovery process where you just said, I just can't take it anymore, I just don't want to do this anymore, I'm not sure I want to be with this man anymore? Did that ever come up?
Oh, yes, and it's important that caregivers understand that that is utterly normal. How inhuman it would be if they didn't feel that way. It's normal to feel anger, resentment, that you want to escape, all of those things. And as I said, the challenge is to be able to nourish yourself and the one that you love. And I needed to carve out more time for myself. Mm-hmm. For example, I needed to be sure that I made time to have lunch dates with girlfriends, just so that I would have normal conversation taking place. I needed to make time to go off and have a massage, or just to change the scene and not have it be about illness, so that I could return home refreshed. Very normal to feel those things. Paul understood.
Yeah. And do you think his expressive way of speaking, has that influenced his writing or your writing? I mean, the fact that he can put together these, you know, wonderful spy elf of the morning hallelujahs as these terms of endearment, has that changed his writing at all or yours?
No.
In a word,
no. Because he was given to synesthesia, and so was I before. And one of the saddest things for me is that during the stroke, he seemed to have lost that funny thing, synesthesia, they call it, where all of your senses get mixed up.
Right.
And very often writers and other kinds of artists have that, and they're able to make metaphors and so on. No, that stayed the same. I think his writing since the stroke has become a little simpler than it was before. The sentence structures have. And he will always need a literary assistant because of that, because it's still aphasic in different ways. But he still gets great joy out of writing. And that's what's important.
Let me get some callers in on the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. And we have John from Princeton joining us on Radio Times. And John, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
Yeah, thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
So I was just wondering, because my dad had a stroke when I was 16. He was about 57. And what I felt was, obviously, you start off with terror and then swung wildly into overcompensating in terms of looking after him, where for him it was very difficult to accept that. And I thought, listening to you talking about your husband, that for a guy that was just an amazing switch to go from being, you know, fully functional to having to rely totally on someone without the sort of ego diving in the way. And I wondered what you'd, how that had worked out for you, because it just seems incredible to me that he was able to do that.
You're absolutely right, and especially so since he'd been a professor for 30 years, he was an RAF officer, he'd been used to being in charge, and I overcompensated too. One tends to do that, and I had to learn to give him the opportunity to fail and have more of a sense of autonomy.
And John, you were a teenager at the time,
yes,
so
which is
a, you know, that's a different kind of relationship, and this is your dad that we're talking
and
about.
And quite young dad too.
Yeah, it was actually it was the same night. My mom had, my dad had a stroke and my mom had a heart attack on the same night.
Oh my god.
It sort of dropped in deep water immediately.
Yes.
But
I hope you're okay, John.
Yeah, no, you learn, and it's but it was definitely, you know, rapidly learning that even though Dad couldn't talk, but there was everything was going on inside his head, so you just had to sort of try and figure out how to let him do that, as you say, without without affecting his dignity, really.
Indeed. Sort of, and that's very hard balance to achieve. And you learn by swinging, as you said, from one to the other, and there's nothing wrong with that.
John, I appreciate the call to Radio
Absolutely.
Times. Let's see what Lorette from Jessup, Georgia has to say. And Lorette, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Hi there. I just thought I'd like to share a little story about my grandmother who had a stroke. And during her recovery process, she worked very diligently on names. That was a difficult thing for her. And she eventually got to the point where she remembered and could recognize all her children and even her grandchildren and their spouses, with the exception of my mother, who was her baby, her youngest child. Hmm. And from the point of recovery until her death, which was about 10 years later, my mother was known as, you know, the baby, the one the Americans stole away.
Well, that puts so a nice, funny twist on it, yeah.
Just call her Stolen Away. That's her nickname.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
And I so appreciate your words, and specifically Paul's words that you read about the changes in his physical being.
Yes.
Through death and even the grave robbers at the end.
Yeah,
I just ended being a caretaker of my husband who passed away with pancreatic cancer. And
I'm
some of those words and feelings are things that we went through as a couple.
Well, I appreciate
it. I look forward to reading your book.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Lorette, for calling into Radio Times. And again, you can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. How common is stroke?
Stroke is the number one long-term disability in the U.S., and it doesn't just strike the elderly. This is what people don't understand. Traumatic brain injuries like stroke, 300,000 a year from traffic accidents.
Wow.
And the Pentagon says that soldiers, well, there are about 400,000 since the year 2000 who have come home with traumatic brain injuries with a lot of the same symptoms. And, of course, the medical system isn't prepared to take care of them. Usually they don't have enough insurance and so on. But they have a lot of these issues, and they can be quite young.
Well, and you actually were on a book tour, The Alchemy of the Mind,
yes.
Which was about the brain when your husband had this particular stroke. You were actually at his bedside, but nonetheless, that book had just been written. So you sort of know the brain from the inside
out. I knew that with this kind of damage, you don't recover 100%. But you can improve. Only I also knew that it would be a marathon effort because that's the way the brain learns. Unfortunately, it's by repetition, not just for people who are injured, but just the rest of us who, as we're getting older, would like to keep our brains alert. You have to repeat things over and over and over and over. And that's, for example, how people learn how to play the violin.
Sure.
You know, they rehearse 10,000 times. How people become surgeons and how one stays mentally fit also as one gets older.
Well, and certainly in this repetition, which can sound like drudge work.
Yes.
But I guess part of what you were trying to do was to introduce play and language.
That's
and
right.
Flirtation.
So it wouldn't be... It's quite so much drudgery. I knew that one had to hear a word said about 2,000 times before
wow.
it would get embedded in memory. And Paul couldn't remember hummingbird, checkbook, various other things. And I would put them on a card, and I'd try to say them during the day. So I said to him, do you think hummingbirds have wallets? Because he had trouble remembering wallet. And he laughed, and I said, well, okay, so what do you think hummingbirds keep in their wallets? And, you know, we played that game, sugar or whatever.
And
yes.
and that was sort of helping to unlock his creative mind, obviously.
Yes, by having associations with it as well to help him remember. And now, of course, he does remember how to say, proudly remembers right. how to say hummingbird.
And do they have wallets?
Maybe they do have their version of it.
Do you worry about him having another stroke? I mean, is that
sure.
something you think about?
He's 20 years older than I am. Yes, I do, of course. What can one do?
Yeah. I mean, do you watch him like a Like a hawk?
I try not to watch him too much or worry too much, but I do. What can I do. The more you love someone, the more you worry about losing them. It's inevitable that that will happen. But I think that I will look back on this time as nonetheless one of the happiest of my life because I felt so thoroughly loved and I was able to give so much love. And not having children, it's been a gift to be able to give love to this extent and to groom and look after and try to improve the life of someone that I care for. So, and also, I've always been a carpe diem sort of gal, you know?
Seize the day.
I live for the day. Always been happy to be alive. Mm. And I think that that will continue. I will always be full of wonder about the planet we live on.
And does that mean you might be working on another book or thinking about another book?
It does, and I can't really tell you about it now, but I will. I'll come back.
Well, Diane Eckerman, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times, and good luck to you and your
husband.
Thank
you so much.
You're very welcome. And her new book is called 100 Names for Love, and it's subtitled A Stroke, A Marriage, and the Language of Healing. Diane Eckerman is a poet. She's an essayist, a naturalist. She's written a number of other books, including The Zookeeper's Wife, A Natural History of the Senses, Dawn, Light, and a book that she wrote a couple of years ago called An Alchemy of the Mind. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. It's produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty Leswing, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscowane, and you're listening to WHYY-FM Philadelphia and WHYY.org, member-supported public media. And you can